and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, the Scale Up and Change Up marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark Renekus.
And I'm Harry Neal. And today's podcast guest is Whitney Bromberg Hawkins, co-founder and CEO of flower delivery service Flowerbox. Welcome to Wax Lyrical, Whitney, and thank you for joining us.
It's so great to be here. And the sun is shining at last in London.
It is, which is nice to see. I think we had a good week of sunshine. So I think to start with, we should talk about Flowerbox, the brand. So it's certainly distinctive. And as we're in a kind of an audio situation, I'm going to have to describe it. So Flowerbox is written in capital letters, and you've purposely missed out the O in box. Can you tell us how you kind of came up with the name and the story about the branding and why you made that choice?
That's such a good question. I was trying to think of a name for Flowerbox, and obviously any names that were very obviously related to flowers were taken as far as domains internationally, and anything sort of great was already taken, including the name Flowerbox. Then I also was thinking of brands like Spanx and brands that really stuck out in my mind that were missing letters or sort of a play on a traditional way of saying a word. And I think that disruptive sort of messing it up a little bit was something that really appealed to me, because essentially that's what we have done to the flower market. So that's where the origin of the name came from. And of course, we could find that name everywhere. We could buy the domain in every territory. So that was sort of the origins of that. Also, I read that brands that have a K in their name, like including Kodak, Coca-Cola, Spanx, really huge brands historically have that strong K sound in their name. So that was an afterthought, but I thought, okay, that ticks that box too.
Lovely post-rationalization. And obviously, I've done a bit of research, so I kind of looked at you. But for our listeners who maybe have heard of you but haven't experienced you, tell us that question. Yeah, what is the Flowerbox experience? If I was to go online, what happens?
What happens is you buy flower, you choose flowers. So I wanted to sort of make it almost encyclopedic how you choose flowers, because I think, first of all, a lot of people don't know the technical biological names of flowers, and buying flowers is a sort of daunting experience. So what I wanted to do is make it really simple and almost encyclopedic how you purchase flowers. So I also didn't love all the sort of flower websites were so fussy and so confused and sort of so many colors and so much. So I wanted to sort of strip it back and create, similar to what Net-a-Porter or Matches did with clothes, sort of just clean it up and present it in a really straightforward way. So you go on the site, you see our best-selling flowers. We sell only single-stem flowers. So I also hated the way that sort of you would choose what you wanted to send, and what the recipient received was nothing like what you chose, because the way the floral model works is you send whatever you have. So it doesn't matter what they choose. You basically send whatever you have in the shop. And that's the way a traditional florist worked. The way we work is we literally cut to order whatever you order. So if you buy 20 pale pink, beautiful avalanche roses, we have them cut on your behalf from the growers. They come to our London warehouse tomorrow morning on a lorry at 4 o'clock in the morning. We recondition them, sort of make sure they're optimal, another quality check, and send them out to you tomorrow. So first of all, you're getting exactly what you ordered. There are no sort of substitutions. There's no, oh, this will do. So that sort of consistency of branded experience is key. You're also getting flowers that are literally 5 or 6 days fresher than you would normally get, because normally they go to the Covent Garden market, they sit for 2 or 3 days, then they're sold to a florist, they sit for 2 or 3 days, and then they're sold to you. So you're getting this, and really crucially, you're also getting flowers that haven't been marked up those two times along the way. So you're getting fresher flowers, you're getting better value, you're getting exactly what you wanted to order. So we've created, well, what I set out to do was create a flower brand, and to create an international flower brand. So if you go to Gucci in London, in Shanghai, in Texas, you're getting the same sort of consistent branded experience, you're getting the same ribbon, you're getting the same tissue paper, you're getting, you know what you're getting. And with flowers, you really historically have no idea what you're getting or no idea what you're paying money for. So I wanted to create a flower brand. And I think I'm going to humbly say we have successfully done that. And getting Flowerbox is a different experience than getting anything else.
And I'm not just saying this, but the site looks amazing. And we'll come on to the look because there's something very, very distinctive, a distinctive name and a distinctive look. So congratulations on that. As we're recording, we are emerging from lockdown, fingers crossed. How has it been for you, both personally and professionally, Whitney?
Well, there was a moment last March, I think like any business owner, where I thought like, this is it. This is the end. We are dead. You know, half of our business historically had been B2B, which literally just went off the cliff. So we had the Chelsea Flower Show was coming up in May. There was like over £500,000 of events and sort of installations that just literally that day just disappeared. So there was, and I had teams around the world in New York, in London and in Paris that were focused on the B2B opportunities, which literally just disappeared. I also had no idea that consumer habits were going to shift and our B2C sales were going to go parabolic. So I didn't know that. In hindsight, it was all fine. But I, at that point, I was like, we're done. I have no more company. We were also in the middle of a fundraise. So, of course, investors were super skeptical at that point. So half of our fundraise pulled out. They're like, give us 6 months. And I was like, I don't have 6 months. I don't have 3 months. So there was it was a really nail-biting sort of few months last March. Then, you know, as I mentioned, our B2C sales went totally parabolic and people were at home. They were lonely. They weren't connected with people that they missed. They were missing occasions. They were missing birthdays. They were missing anniversaries. So they were sending flowers. Not only that, it was one of the few things you could actually enjoy. So I remember, you know, I'd get my sort of vegetable delivery from Natura and I would get my flower box delivery from Flower Box. And those were the two, literally the only two things other than my family that provided any sort of beauty or joy in my life at that point. It was pretty bleak time. So lockdown was challenging, extremely challenging. We had to completely pivot the business to B2C, and all of the business was laser focused on the opportunity. We took advantage of the quote opportunity and launched the East Coast of the US throughout, you know, this was last April, it was right before US Mother's Day. And I was like, look, we've got to take advantage of the fact that we can still function and we can still operate and we can still deliver and help people connect with their moms, connect with their grandmoms, connect with people they aren't going to be with. Then in October, we launched the West Coast of the US. Again, you know, found the warehouse on Zoom, interviewed people on Zoom. I still haven't met them face to face. But it was a real question of, you know, this is what the situation is and how are we gonna survive, really? So I think it was a real question of survival mode.
It's a really interesting way of kind of talking about it and how even through a pandemic, you found a way to grow and found a way to expand probably more than you kind of were planning to as part of 2020. I think looking at kind of going forward, do you see kind of the B2C being a bigger part or direct to consumer being a bigger aspect of your company and your business going forward?
Yeah, it's funny because B2C is what I always want. The reason I started Flower Box was to be a direct to consumer online flower business. And then I think I got sidetracked by this sort of, there's a Louis Vuitton event in Versailles and that's, you know, a huge amount of money. I think what I also didn't acknowledge was what a huge sort of drain it was on the company, the sort of artistic direction and the proposals back and forth. So I think what COVID did was allow me to refocus on the reason I started Flower Box anyway, was direct to consumer online flower delivery company. That said, B2B is coming back really faster and more meaningfully than I thought it was as sort of brands need to re-engage with customers and they have increased confidence and obviously people are having entertaining now. So how I hope we can continue to treat B2B as sort of the icing on the cake, but not build, you know, big teams and not treat it as a core focus of the business.
On the note of why you kind of started Flower Box and things like that, I think one of the things that makes Flower Box so unique is what you've described previously as your negative working capital model. I know you've kind of touched on it already in terms of how flowers are cut to order, but could you tell us a little bit more about that and the impact it kind of has or the kind of the positive impact it has environmentally or sustainability wise?
One of the main reasons for when I sort of looked into the floral industry is I realized that 60% of flowers that go into a flower shop are wasted. So there's a huge amount. It's equivalent to food waste that's thrown out. So I wanted to, first of all, I didn't want to create a company that had a negative environmental impact. So that was one of the motives. I think the other motive was the fact that having this negative working capital business model, which was challenging at the beginning, because people are like, what do you mean? I've got to wait. At that point, it was 2 days to get flowers. And I'm like, yes, you have to wait 2 days. But presumably, you know, it's your friend's birthday, you know, the week before. Presumably, you know, you're having a dinner party the week before. So I think there was a real lesson in re-educating people that the inconvenience of having to wait a little bit was balanced by you got fresher flowers, you had no sort of negative environmental impact, you were spending less money on your flowers, and you were getting better quality and value. So there was this real re-education piece, which we found again in New York when people are like, can I get it in 20 minutes? And you're like, no, you can't get it in 20 minutes. And, you know, here are, so it's a real re-education piece. I think once people see the product and they see they're getting better quality and they're getting better value and all of the sort of advantages, then they get it. Also the fact that we're not substituting, you know, we're not just sending, they ask for pink roses and we're sending, you know, yellow daffodils because that's what we have in stock. So I think the advantages outweigh the slight inconvenience. We also now do have some same day and next day. We have an express delivery service. So we know, we have predictive ability to know what our best sellers are and what people will, you know, are going to order. But that was sort of a few years in coming.
Earlier on, I alluded to the fact, and I'm trying to be objective, a distinctive brand, literally in the name and the way you say it, but a really distinctive look on the website. And please don't be offended by this. There's a hint, I guess, and I know you talk about this a lot, but you're famous for having worked for Tom Ford for a big chunk of your life. So I'm guessing that was one of the things you got from Tom, was this beautiful aesthetic. But back to Tom, what was it that prompted you to leave what must have been the most amazing job in fashion and start up on your own? Were you crazy?
I literally thought I was crazy. And, you know, I could have easily stayed there and worked, you know, next to Tom for the rest of my life and been totally happy. I got recruited and headhunted quite often, and I knew I couldn't find a better job. There is no better job that existed than the one I had, but also because of the history I had with Tom and because of the trust we'd built up after 20 years together, you know, I had really great freedom. I had really great trust. I had, you know, he's godfather to my two kids. My husband is the SVP of menswear at Tom Ford and has been for 23 years. So there was also this family element, which was made it feel like, what am I doing? I was also nervous that if I wasn't working with my husband, you know, what is our marriage going to fall apart? We had only met at work and fell in love at Gucci. So I was really nervous. Like, so a lot of my identity was wrapped up in working for Tom. That said, you know, Tom always said, you've got to have a 10-year plan. Like, it's so important to have a 10-year plan. He says this all the time. And I remember it sort of really resonated with me. And in my 20s, I was, you know, worked, built up my career, work at all costs. I worked day and night. You know, then my 30s was definitely about having a family while also building my career. And then I was turning 40 and I was like, oh my God, are my 40s going to be sitting editors that were getting younger and younger? They weren't even editors anymore. They were sort of bloggers. And they were like, I don't like my seat at the fashion show. And I was like, I don't care at all. So I think while I could have gone and done it for the rest of my life, I also had grown up and I was, you know, wanted to worry about more than like, was Tom going to be happy? Is Tom? So it was an extremely difficult situation. I was also pregnant with my third child. And I think, it was sort of a perfect storm of having my third child, turning 40. It was like a midlife moment. And I was like, it's either now or never. And if I don't do it now, then I will probably very happily still be working for Tom for the rest of my life. And the idea, sorry. I mean, I think it's also, I had the idea and I was like, I started it as a side hustle for a minute for like 5 or 6 months. And I thought, oh, I can hire someone to manage it. But then I realized it was never going to be anything if I didn't go and put everything behind it.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we hear a lot when we talk to people who have started companies and founders, and they talk about how they had to invest their whole self into the business in order to make it a success, because unless you're fully in it, you're not in it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Natalie Massenet, who's one of our early investors, the founder of Net-a-Porter, was like, this is never going to be anything if you don't go and make it something. Because it could have just fizzled. I think it would have been a nice slow burn, but I don't think it ever would have been big.
You've kind of spoken a little bit about how it was working for Tom, but I think one of the more interesting questions is actually, what did you actually learn from him? And what have you used going forward that's made Flowerbox what it is today?
I mean, there's no better person in the world at building a brand, at creating desire around an object, at telling a story so that you feel like if you don't have that object, your life is not going to be as good. He's taught me the importance of hard work and like total dedication. I think one thing that Tom taught me that is invaluable is like saying no. So much of like success and building a strong brand is what you say no to, because there are so many opportunities and you're like, oh, this could be good, or this could be good exposure. Maybe I should do that. And when you're starting out, it's so hard to be disciplined about, you know, things and opportunities that aren't on brand or aren't right for Flowerbox. But I was really, I basically spent 20 years saying no to people for Tom. So I was pretty disciplined about saying no to things that weren't right, that didn't feel right, where the, you know, the alignment wasn't there.
When we were chatting about lockdown, you alluded to the fact that you were amidst funding, thinking about the whole lifetime of Flowerbox. How easy was it finding investors? And as importantly, what advice do you have for others who are listening, who are seeking investment? For example, what kind of people should you take on as an investor?
Ugh, we're in the middle of our Series A right now, so fundraising is not my favorite topic. I would say, so I had this amazing chairman, his name was Mark Seba, and he had previously been the CEO of Net-a-Porter for 17, I think, years. And he said to me, your investors are it's your club of people. And he said, don't take money from anyone you don't want in your club and in the Flowerbox club. And this was really early on. And I was like, I'll take money from anyone. But you realize that it's a lifelong relationship. It's literally a marriage. And these people are going to be involved with Flowerbox throughout the entire lifespan of it. So I would say, first of all, find a great anchor. You know, Natalie Massenet, Mark Seba, and Carmen Bousquet, who was an early partner in Net, were our first investors. And once you have some great investors on board, it's a lot easier to sell the story to other people. So I would say, find a good anchor. And it's much easier to find followers if you have a good anchor. I would also say just talk to anyone and everyone. It's exhausting. It's tireless. But, you know, some of the most unsuspecting people have been the most supportive investors in Flowerbox.
We've kind of touched on what makes Flowerbox different, I think, and what makes it stand out in the market. But I think if you had to describe it in a sentence, what makes Flowerbox better or distinctive within the flower delivery market, what would you say?
I mean, I think our strapline pretty much says it all. Extraordinary flowers delivered. We deliver extraordinary. We deliver beauty. We deliver quality. We have taken something that's usually a disappointing experience and made it an extraordinary experience. And that's what flowers should be. The emotional power of flowers needs to be, the packaging needs to be extraordinary. The experience needs to be extraordinary. The online, you know, experience needs to be, or isn't quite yet, but it will be, you know, the whole user experience needs to be extraordinary. And why has no one never created an extraordinary experience with flowers?
Well, I want to talk more about flowers. I can see you getting animated. And I'll be honest, I love flowers. I have been known as a hopeless romantic to, without any reason, come home with a nice bunch of flowers for my husband and just give him to them for no reason whatsoever. I love the smell. I love the way they cheer up a room. By the way, we disagree about lilies. He's got a thing about lilies. He doesn't like the smell of lilies. Anyway, I won't tell you what he thinks they smell like. But I've read that you don't like to say what your favourite flower is, which sounds a bit like you're refusing to pick your favourite child. Can't imagine why you would not do that. But anyway, how about you tell me what flowers you would send me and why?
Well, it really depends on the season. I think like what's your favorite food completely depends on what season it is. You know, asparagus right now is amazing, British asparagus, but if in November, it's definitely not my favorite food. Same with like cherries right now. So I think choosing what's seasonal is key, exactly like with food. So right now I would send you peonies for sure. There is no more beautiful flower right now in the month of June than peonies. And 100%, hands down, without hesitation, I would send you peonies. That said, in, you know, end of July, peonies aren't available anymore, and dahlia are so amazing. So I would send you like just the magnificent dahlia. And then hydrangea come back in season. So, you know, in the fall, it would definitely be hydrangea with those, like the ones you have behind you, with those huge heads that are so autumnal. They last really long. They really make you feel so happy at home. So it really depends on the season.
It sounds like you love them all.
I do. And what's exciting with flowers is they're gone for a year. When they come back, we're all so excited to see them. And they're all, it's sort of like, oh, you're back again. They feel new. You know, having sweet peas in the warehouse right now just feels like, oh, you're so pretty and I've missed you so much. So there's a constant sort of amazement and newness to working with flowers.
When you go to someone else's house and you see the flowers that they have and what they're presenting, does that tell you anything about them at all?
Oh, everything. Everything. The same way like your outfit tells, it's the way you sort of accessorize an outfit that can completely change an outfit. I mean, you have on a little black dress and you can change that little black dress completely with your heels, your bag, your sunglasses, your necklace, your bracelets, and you can turn it from 60s to 80s to anything from your accessory. So I feel like flowers do the same thing to a room. You know, you can be romantic and pretty, or you can be sort of more sculptural and architectural, or you can be, so it completely changes the mood of a room.
You mentioned earlier that you launched in the US in lockdown, so congratulations for that. And the business has been an undeniable success. According to my notes, you're in 24 countries across Europe and the US now. So look, you must get approached for advice and mentoring by lots of people, including other founders, I'm sure. How do you decide who to say yes to, and how do you hope to help them?
Well, I'm helped by so many people that I think it's only right to give it back whenever anyone wants any advice that I can share. I feel like it's my duty, having been through like a war zone for the past 4 or 5 years, that I should help anyone through with any wisdom I've acquired. And I'm lucky that I have founder friends and mentors that are further along in the journey than I am, that say, oh, don't do this, or oh, there's a pitfall of launching in the US, or oh, here, don't take money from these people. Or so I have people that are ahead of me on the journey and then people behind me. So I'm always asking for advice, and I'm always sharing whatever advice I can share too with anyone who cares, who's interested. And I also have a very close group of founder friends that I think is vital. It's like a support group. So it's like someone you can be like, oh, my COO just quit, or oh my, you know, just, that's just someone that gets and feels your pain.
Looking back at the past 5 years at Flowerbox, tell us about the highs and also the lows that you've faced.
It is literally a roller coaster. Whoever said founding a company, you can be on top of the world and it's like the best day and the best thing, and you're like, we are going to win this. This is amazing. We are on top of the world. And then the next day it can be like, oh, is anyone ever going to buy a flower again? So it's, you know, or a big event pulls or something, and you're like, oh my God, how are we even going to do this? So I think the roller coaster situation is very real, and the highs are very high and the lows are very low. So some of the highs, I don't know, I keep waiting for that one moment. You know, everyone says, oh, and then there was this moment where we knew we made it. I'm like, I'm still waiting for that moment. But the highs have been, you know, what I think a lot of the external sort of approbation that we've had. Tiffany last year in New York wanted to launch a flower box. Flower shop in Tiffany, and they ended up investing like probably $1 million in building this flower box flower shop. And then they had co-branded vans driving around New York, and then they had co-branded buses, and then they like did this huge PR push. Then they hosted a breakfast for me at Tiffany's last year, right before Valentine's Day. So I think, first of all, the fact that they wanted to co-brand with us, and they've never co-branded with anyone in the history of Tiffany's, meant, wow, like we built a brand strong enough that it can sit alongside Tiffany, which is, you know, in America, just the most iconic sort of heritage American brand. There's like Ralph Lauren and there's Tiffany. And so that was a big sort of like pinch me moment. there was a huge piece in the New York Times where I remember like my dad's friends were calling and they're like, and I was like, oh my gosh, like we're really there. And then also when we did really, it was quite early on when we did the facade of Annabelle's nightclub in London. I'm not sure if you saw that, but it's on Berkeley Square and it was for the Chelsea Flower show. And it just went viral. I mean, I think flowers covering that iconic building in the middle of Berkeley Square, but I sort of knew it would go viral. But what I loved is that it was better because it was Flower Box. So everyone was tagging us and it wasn't just another floral display. It was like, check this out by Flower Box. And that was sort of put us on the map in a, oh, you did that type of way.
Tom's advice to have a 10-year plan. Thinking about that, I guess you're halfway through the Flower Box 10-year plan. Are you where you expected to be? And tell us, where do you want to be at the end of the 10-year plan?
Well, where I want to be is that you can buy flowers and from any of the sort of people you buy flowers from, or you can buy Flower Box. And I want it to be a noun. I remember Holly Rogers, who's the CEO of Browns, like texted me and she's like, I got a Flower Box. And I want it to be, you can get flowers or you can get a Flower Box. And it means a completely different thing. And I want it to be everywhere. I would love for me, if I have a friend in, you know, Dubai, who's getting married, I want to be able to send her Flower Box the same way I want to be able to send my, you know, friend's daughter in Texas flowers. So I want to be everywhere and I want it to be a global solution. So I think until it's a global solution, I won't be satisfied.
Looking at, you know, flower companies or just generally gifting companies in the UK, I think a lot of them have a lot of different aspects to them and deliver more than flowers or more than a gift. I think looking at Flower Box, do you see yourselves diversifying at all? And if so, how do you see yourself doing it?
Actually, so we have beautiful candles and room spray. We have amazing vases that are so chic because I didn't want to have, like, every time I'd send flowers or I would get flowers, they were in like a cylinder vase and everyone has cylinder vases under their sink and no one wants to put anything in the cylinder vase. So I wanted to create vases that were as special as the flowers themselves. So we have vases. We launched last year, we sold Christmas trees. We also launched these beautiful handmade velvet Christmas tree skirts. Literally, we sold out. I guess I was like, they were quite expensive because they were hand sewn and they were beautiful Italian velvet. So I was like, let's just dip our toe in the water. And we sold out in like 4 days. We had to get it. We like rushed the second batch. And this was in November. So I think there's definitely an appetite for, I think there's a trust that we will deliver beauty and we will deliver quality. And there's an appetite for other gifts, sort of ancillary gifting objects. We sell beautiful floral scissors. We sell chocolates, Charbonneau and Walker chocolate. We sell champagne. But I think there's definitely the opportunity to become sort of the sine qua non for beautiful gifting, like lifestyle gifting.
So I'm guessing that working for, and probably yourself as a fashion icon for so long, you developed a skill for solving fiascos. How do you deploy that skill now, if at all?
Every single day, every single hour, all of the time. I think, you know, fashion, I think, is underrated as far as how hard people work and how much stuff goes wrong. I mean, there was never a night before the show where we weren't up, like, pumicing jeans to make the fade right, where there weren't heels falling off shoes, where the, you know, there was, fashion is full of sort of fiascos. And flowers are worse because flowers die. So like you're dealing with something that's literally dying the second you have your hands on it. So perishability adds a whole nother element of disaster to the mix. So yes, literally having your own company is one fiasco after another. All day, every day, 7 days a week, all of the time.
So we are now at our signature question, which is all about your favorite TV ad. So here we go. What is yours and why? And as we are in an audio format, if you can do the best you can to describe it, that would be great.
Sure. I'm not sure it's my favorite all time ever ad, but definitely the one that has resonated with me most. Most recently is the Uber ad the sort of series of Uber ads that came out right at the beginning of the pandemic, where Uber just showed real snippets of life and what people were going through and all the different unique things. You know, some people were old and they were isolated. Some people were younger and had small kids at home. And some people were had just fallen in love. So it really showed all the different things that people were going through, but it was sort of this universal collective thing that we were all going through, but all of our experiences were so unique in this collective huge thing that we were all, challenge that we were all facing. I think what was also really powerful about it is they just switched their strap line, because I think saying don't ride with us, like don't spend your money with us, keep everyone safe. And basically I think a company saying don't actually buy us because you're doing a favor for the world was so sort of the right thing to do. And it just really resonated with me, because I think throughout COVID, so many people who were marketing just got it so wrong. I remember getting, email newsletters with like, check out this cute pair of heels. And you're like, what? I mean, it couldn't even be less relevant. So I think the relevance was so tricky. And for me as, the CEO of a company, of course I needed to sell flowers. I desperately needed to sell flowers. But it was so important to me that the message of hope, that the message of beauty, the message of connectivity, the message of I love you was at the forefront and not selling the flowers. And I felt a huge responsibility to our customers to keep delivering and to not let them down, because so many other things sort of were letting us all down at that point.
Yeah, lovely ad. I hadn't seen it, so thank you for bringing it to my attention. Made by Wieden & Kennedy, the famous ad agency, but from their office in Portland. And I agree. It has, I think, made a lot of CEOs and senior marketers. I think they've learned a bit about where the line is between what marketing can and can't do. And if anybody's listening, I recommend going back to a podcast where our guest was Jeff Dodds, the COO of Virgin Media. And he was faced with quite a challenge. I think we were recording right as we'd gone into lockdown. He was quite honest. And he was saying that he was due to spend a lot of money on TV and didn't know what to do. But in the end, he and his team worked out that as long as we can be relevant and authentic, then we can be on air. And his was one of a few, I think, decent, as is the Uber ad, user-generated ads, because we were all in lockdown. Nobody knew if we could or how we could make films, but a lot of people did make some genuine, authentic and relevant, that was the word you used, Whitney, which I agree, relevant advertising that kept the brand front, but actually didn't do it in an aggressive and in a tasteless way. So yeah, thank you for choosing that. And thank you for being our guest today. Sadly, that brings us to the end of the podcast. Thank you for sharing your stories. They've all been fascinating. Thank you. Best of luck for the future, for the remaining 5 years of at least your first 10-year plan. I sense there'll be a second 10-year plan and possibly even a third 10-year plan in there. So the best of luck for that. I look forward to seeing your business go on to even greater success. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a treat chatting to you. Thank you so much.
And yes, Harry, welcome, I guess, even though I've left it till right at the end of the podcast, your very first podcast. Thank you for joining us on the podcast. Did you enjoy it?
I did. Looking forward to more in the future.
Okay, we'll see you soon. Take care. Bye-bye.